in this morning, possibly last night. Thank you for joining us. Thank you to Nishmat for sponsoring this program, and hopefully we will experience Me'afela Liora on two fronts. Typically, when we speak of Me'afela Liora, we speak about it as darkness and light, struggle versus redemption, frustration versus success, Sarah versus Yeshua. That's why Nachinu, Me'afela Liora Mishibi Lagula. But under these circumstances, the phrase Me'afela Liora has a second connotation. There are many layers to this war. The most obvious layer is the military layer. I'm just going to adjust my camera. It's a military layer. Excuse me about that. It's a military layer. It's also a war between good and evil, a clash of civilizations, between a bloodthirsty culture which celebrates death and torture, rape, and burning people alive, and there's no sense of the dignity of human beings. Essentially, they're paganists. They speak in the name of God, but they don't speak of the right God. They speak of a God who's angry and bloodthirsty and vengeful. So it's tantamount to either atheism or paganism, call it what you want. And a culture that celebrates life as a gift from HaKadosh Baruch Hu and the dignity of life that he bestowed upon human beings. And it's really a battle between good and evil, between light and dark. And as always, we're at the forefront, which we'll speak about in this year. So Me'afela Liora doesn't just mean from difficult circumstances to more triumphant and successful circumstances, but let's defeat dark with good, with light, and with the values that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us to represent in this world on his behalf. So, this week's Parsha, Parshas Vayetze, contains the most iconic, probably, the two most iconic scenes in the entire Sefer Bereishis. One is the Akedah, and two is the Sulam Yaakov, the Ladder of Yaakov, Mutzav Arza, Rosha Magia Shemaima. In many ways, Yaakov's Sulam, or as it's called in common culture, Jacob's Ladder, is even more wildly popular cross-culturally. Even religions or even cultures that don't speak in religious terms or don't use the Bible as their baseline, the concept of a ladder stationed on earth, bridging to heaven, is one which captures the imagination, the human imagination, looking for some higher purpose, bridging the two worlds, escaping the limitations of our world and scaling the heavens. So many connotations, and it evokes so many aims and aspirations. But what does this imagery and this symbol mean to us? So the Medrash Rabbah, Medrash Tanchuma, primarily in Parshas Vayetze, highlights three different metaphors, the third of which I'd like to speak about today. The first and obvious metaphor is the Beis HaMikdash. The foot of the Sulam was in Be'er Sheva, and he was on his way to Haran, and the top of the ladder, some say the middle of the ladder, some say the apex of the ladder, but it was hovering above Yushalayim, hovering above the Beis HaMikdash, and this was Yaakov's moment, as he says, Efshar She'elech Memakom She'elchu Avosai Ve'eno Mispalel. He ignores the fact, he's oblivious to the fact, he's traveling in the Makom HaKedah, the Beis HaMikdash, he realizes it, he travels back, or he sojourns the night, and this is Yaakov's encounter with Beis HaMikdash, this is Yaakov's encounter with Korbanos, this is Yaakov's HaKedah. Avram was at Har Moriah, Yitzchak was at Har Moriah. This is Yaakov's moment to be at Har Moriah and to imagine the korbanos that will one day be brought for Avram and Yitzchak. They actually sacrificed the Ayel Achar Nachaz Basvach Bekarnav. For Yaakov, it's more conceptual, more metaphoric. Malachei Elokim Olim Yerdimbo, accessing HaKadosh Baruch Hu in Shemayim through our korbanos. And of course, he doesn't offer a korban, but he comes close. He builds a matseva, which at least at his stage in history was the equivalent or the rough equivalent of a mizbech. So one version in Chazal is that it represents the Beis HaMikdash, the mizbech, and korbanos. The other version is that the Sulam Mutzav Arza, the second version, evokes Har Sinai, Matan Torah, in which heaven and earth were bridged, in which HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself, the Chvodo V'Atzmo, descended onto Har Sinai, in which Malachei Elokim, as the Medrash says, are Aharon and Moshe Olim V'Yardimbo. So it represents human beings scaling to Shemayim, bringing down Torah from Shemayim for a human audience. So even though Mata and Tara is hundreds of years in the future, Yaakov already gets a preview for this experience. Even though it's not at Har Sinai, it's at Har Moriah. Har Moriah is aptly named, according to one version in Chazal, because Misham Hara Yotzeis L'chol Yisrael. Har Moriah was not just a site for Avoda, it's a site for Tara. It's a site where the Sanhedrin HaGadolah sat and illustrated Torah Shebal Peh. Of course, the Sefer Torah was contained in the Kodesh HaKadoshim. So visiting Har Moriah is not just a moment to think about Korbanos, either past Korbanos or future Korbanos, but it's also an opportunity to think about the role of Torah. Chazal say there are Avos study Torah, Yaakov in particular, the 14 lost years, which Chazal attribute, when I say lost, I mean they're not in the text. Yaakov, the last we see Yaakov, he's 63 when he receives the brachos. He's a 63-year-old still listening to his mother, to Rivka. And when he arrives at Lavan, based on the calculations of how old he is, when he meets Paro in Yosef's life, the last Rashi in Parshas told us, he's 77. So if he travels to Lavan when he's 77 and he receives the brachos when he's 63, 14 years intervene. Those are the 14 years he spends studying Torah. It's the third symbol of the ladder, which Chazal highlight, which I want to elaborate upon. The ladder is not a bridge of Korbanos and a Mizbeach. The ladder is not Har Sinai. The ladder is what you could call the highway of history. And upon that highway, there are malachim, or there are milachim, there are kings, ascending and descending. And Yaakov witnesses the unfolding future of history, that empires rise, and as the Medrash says, each empire rises to greater heights than the previous empire. But ultimately, they're not just Olim, but Yordimbo. As high as they rise, they fall. And Yaakov is witnessing the ladder of history upon which different empires are embarking, rising, and falling. This event was already experienced by his grandfather Avraham during the Bris Bein HaBisarim. We don't know where the Bris Bein HaBisarim occurred. It isn't tagged in the Torah. As far as I know, Chazal don't tag it. It would be appropriate to imagine that it happened on Har Moriah. It's hard to imagine another location. But Avraham cuts up some animals and he splits them to create a bris, to walk through the animals with the Tanur Esh, which represents Hashem, so that there's a Bris Bein HaBisarim, the covenant of Jewish history. And according to our Chazal, the animals themselves represented different kingdoms and empires that would occupy this earth and inhabit this earth and dominate this earth. And not only that, but in the middle of the Bris Bein HaBisarim, the Torah writes, V'hine ima chashecha gedola nofela salav, is a dark cloaking darkness that falls on Avram. Ima gedola chashecha nofela salav. Those four terms, ima, gedola, chashecha nofela salav, Chazal took as a reference not just to the general notion of kingdoms ascending and descending in history, but the four particular ones. The question we'll discuss today is, what does this all have to do with us? These famous Arba Malchios, what does it have to do with us? Why is Avram getting a preview of four empires and four kingdoms? Why in particular is Yaakov? What is Yaakov's response to witnessing the rise and fall of different empires? If we have time, we'll talk a little bit about who these empires are, but I don't know if we'll have that much time. I'll have to save that for some other time, and in particular, a fascinating question. Where does Yishmael play in to these four empires? But let's first start with tracing these four empires all the way back. Without stipulating who they are, I'll stipulate them in a moment. Tracing them all the way back to the first time they're mentioned in the Torah. Before the world was created, Bereshis Bara Elokim, Es HaShamayim V'Es HaAretz. When Hashem started to create the earth and the heaven, V'aretz, Haisa, Sahu, V'vohu, V'choshech, Alpanei Sahom. Four terms describing the void, the blackness, the depths, the darkness, the abysses, we would say. Chazal say, these four terms, it's a medrash, Tohu, Vohu, Choshech, and Panei Tahom, represent the four at least in the classic view of Chazal, there are many Rishonim that switch the sequencing and the attribution, but the classic reading of Chazal are these four terms of darkness refer to Nebuchadnezzar Melech Bavel, Paras Umadai, Ahasuerush and Haman, Yavan or Greece, and then Romi slash Edom slash Christianity slash Western civilization. Why are these four empires described as Tohu, Vavohu, void and darkness, V'choshech al p'nei sahom? The answer is these four empires don't just rise incidentally or circumstantially and dominate the world. There's nothing circumstantial about history, and there's certainly nothing circumstantial about the fact that our enemies are always the leaders of the contemporary culture and the political situation. Our wars and our battles are not with second-rate or second-class civilizations or empires. We had no beef with the Mayans in South America or the Malaysians. We always tussled with, our Beis HaMikdash was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar at the prime of his dominance, by the Roman Empire at the prime of its dominance. These four empires arise, occupy the world, dominate the world, but also each of them culturally pose a moral and religious threat to humanity. Each in their own way. What was the threat of Bavel? What was the question of Bavel? It seems to have been the first time that there was a multi-regional power, such as Nebuchadnezzar. Until then, everything had been tribal and localized, but he dominated the entire Levant, the entire Mediterranean crescent, and he became arrogant, and that arrogance led him astray to be blasphemous against HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Seems like it was the arrogance that can accompany grand and great human achievement writ large. The Torah talks about kochi v'yotzim yadi, that you shouldn't be too self-complacent and self-aggrandizing about your financial success. What about the financial success? Multi-regional, spreads across the globe, political, global. What was the challenge of Paras Umadai? As far as we can see, the worship of money. Several generations had conglomerated the monies of the world. Remember, Paras Umadai ransacked Bavel. Bavel ransacked Ashur. So Ashur was one of the first strong empires that collected a lot of money. They were on the coasts of Lebanon. They were seafarers. Their money was taken by Nebuchadnezzar, and his money was taken by Paras Umadai. And of course, a lot of this money came from the Beis HaMikdash, which Nebuchadnezzar had looted. And you see the toxic impact of money, the ostentatiousness of the party, the vulgarity, the voyeurism, and it's no incident that Haman pays for his genocide with shkalim, with money. You can buy anything in Shushan, even genocide. Yavan, of course, we know to be Hellenism, and that interface between beauty and science and piety and religion. And now getting into the hall, Mirtz Hashem over Hanukkah, everyone will have ample time to consider the interface between Hellenism and Judaism, and don't simplify. There's a lot that the Greeks offered that are worthwhile and it's important to absorb, as the Pasuk says, Yafta l'kim l'yafes v'yishkon ba'al Hashem, but certainly the balances have to be properly calibrated. And Rome is, of course, the Christian Western civilization tradition and the dangers it poses without fully elaborating. These are all dangers to humanity. And they are tohu vavohu. They are void, they are darkness. And it is our job, the job of the Jewish people, to protect humanity against these empires and their moral and religious perils which they provide. Our wars, our battles with Nebuchadnezzar, with Paras Umadai, with Yavan over Hanukkah, and over the last 2,000 years with Rome and Christianity and the Western civilization, haven't just been local battles. We are meant to protect humanity from its own demons, as we are now. How do I know this? Where does this come from? It comes from, actually, Parshas Vayera, not Parshas Lech Lecha, where Avram gets a preview of the Jewish role in defeating these nations, and that's why in the Visbein HaBesarim, he shoos away the bird, and he's participating in the vultures being shooed away because he's protecting humanity. And Yaakov is witnessing them rise and fall. It stems from a very interesting metaphor in Parshas Vayera. In Sefer Bereishis, the Jews are compared to three items. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is devising Jewish identity, historical identity. And he compiles it by comparing us to three elements. We're compared to the stars, that's obvious, and I'll talk about this a little bit later. We're supernatural. We aren't affected by the anthropological and natural laws which impact and shape other arcs and other trajectories. We're compared to the dust, Afar Haaretz, and I'll talk about this. And at Har Moriah, when Yaakov has his dream, the dust metaphor is reiterated. We'll talk about why Yaakov hears about dust. But in Parshas Vayera, at the Akedah, for the first time, Avram hears that we're not dust, we're not stars, we're sand. Sand is not the same as dust. We're kechol hayam. What does it mean that we're sand? Why are we compared to sand? The answer is understanding the geological role of sand. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in two successive days of creation, separated the upper waters from the lower waters and established a firm plate separating the higher waters from the lower waters. We call that plate the Rakia, Lavdil Ben Amayim Lamayim. And then on the third day, he condensed all the lower waters into oceans and seas and established dry land for human habitat. We don't have gills. We need to breathe oxygen through our lungs and our noses. We can't filter it from water. Namely, when creation began, the earth was covered with water. Ruach Elokim Merachavas Al Pnei Hamayim. In order to allow humanity to live and prosper, Hashem had to segregate and separate and delimit so that dry land could be created. So first he did it vertically, upper waters, lower waters, Rakia in the middle. And then within our hemisphere, he collected all the waters into oceans and seas and rivers and lakes so that dry land would emerge. However, this is a dynamic interface. The waters, in particular the oceans, they're always trying to overcome dry land and engulf dry land. We call that tides. And the sand is the barge and the fortress that prevents the tides from overrunning dry land. It stands literally at the boundary between dry land and the oceans, and it protects geologically. Well, this, and you go to the beach, you see this geological experience, and we refer to it in Tehillim Kuf Dalet, Gvul Samta Bali Avaron Bayishuvun Lachasos Aretz. It's a parak we recite on Rosh Hashanah. Hashem placed the sand as the boundary between the ocean and preventing the ocean from overcoming dry land. Well, this is not just a geological drama, dry land, sand, and ocean. This is a moral drama. The waters, the original waters, are Ruach Elokim Erachepes, but they're also described, those same waters, as Tohu Vavo, V'choshech HaPenei Tohu. These are not just waters. This is chaos, evil, moral peril, religious challenge, Tohu Vavo. And those waters, namely evil, Tohu Vavo, are always trying to overcome human experience and to defeat human experience, to imperil human experience. Just like the geological ocean is always trying to overcome dry land and engulf it, the moral Tohu Vavo, which is associated with that ocean, is always trying to overcome humanity. That's why Chazal identify Tohu Vavo, Choshech HaPenei Tohu, these waters of danger, of peril, of void, of evil, of chaos. They are the four nations visiting this earth, challenging humanity and potentially morally and religiously defeating and engulfing humanity. And we, Hashem tells Avraham, are the sand. We, like the sand, protect the dry land, humanity, from the waters of Tohu Vavohu, which threaten to engulf them. And it comes to a head at four points in history, where four kingdoms visit this earth, introduce moral challenge, and then our role as the sand barge or the sand fortress of humanity is even more prominent. The pasuk in Yeshaya, I think it's in the Nuns, I have to check it, I don't have the Tanakh in front of me, where the Navi berates the Jewish people for betraying Hashem, for worshiping Avodah Zarah, and then in the middle of his rebuke, which is classic and standard, he says, in the name of Hashem, haven't I made you the sand? And this is the way you repay me? Well, that's a non sequitur. Why would the rebuke of the Jewish people be accentuated because we're like the sand? The answer is we're like the sand because we're supposed to be protecting humanity from evil, from immorality, from incivility, from violence, from paganism, from whatever, from sexual promiscuity. And if we ourselves aren't capable of that behavior, then there's no way we can fulfill our mission and our tasks. So Hashem says, I gave you a task. At the very least, you have to be faithful. You have to express fidelity to me if you mean to inspire it in others. I made you the sand. Namely, to pull it all together. What's happening in Bereishis, the waters and the dry land, is a moral metaphor. It's a metaphor for a moral and religious challenge. The waters geologically overcoming dry land represents the waters of chaos and void and evil trying to overcome human experience, even religious experience. It is a constant drama, but it reaches a height and a pitch at certain points in history, as exemplified by the four kings. Our struggle with the four kings is not a localized struggle over land or Beis HaMikdash, although it takes place centered around those experiences, as Hanukkah did, as Bavel did, as Rome did, and now as our final battle of Yerushalayim is, but we're protecting humanity from their own darker selves, which is why we are called the sand. This is why Avraham and Yaakov have a front row seat to the evolutions of history. Because in each of these moments, Jewish destiny is being forged in their imagination, in their future. Myself is Simon Labanim. So it's crucial that as Avram enters Jewish history at the Bris Mein HaBesarim, and as Yaakov re-enters Jewish history on the mountain of Jewish history, that he understands that part of being a Jew is participating in this battle, protecting humanity, defeating evil, and having the strength and the courage to face off with the big boys, with huge, multi-regional, dominant empires. That is what being a Jew is. We see indomitable juggernauts, and we look right through them, and we realize they're as thin as paper tigers. I grew up, many listening, I don't know your ages, and I'm not seeing you, grew up terrified of the Soviet Union. An empire built to last thousands of years. They had completely crushed Judaism, extinguished Jewish spirit and Jewish identity. No one dared defy them. No one. Who would defy the Soviet Union? Except for a couple Jews in gulags or in prisons in Moscow who said, I want to move to Israel. In 1986, Natan Sharansky crossed the bridge in a suburb of Germany. And in 1988, 89, or 87, a few years later, the wall came tumbling down. Soviet Union dissolved, and it's coughing its last breath. Now, coughing last breath doesn't take place in a year or two, but it's the end of that era, the end of that experience, the end of that dynasty. We defeated the Soviet Union, our resilience and our resolve and our boldness and our stubbornness. We did the same to Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar built a tall idol and demanded that every single nation send emissaries and bow down to his idol. Who would dare to fight it? Nebuchadnezzar killed his own servants for not deciphering his dream properly. We'll talk about those dreams. And the only three people are a couple of young Jews called Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. You don't know much about them beforehand. And they laugh. They don't laugh to belittle the situation, but they see through his fire. They see through his might. They defy him. They depose him. Or they don't depose him politically. But the insult and the embarrassment leads to a dream, which leads to him going raving mad and wandering the forest, half man, half animal, you know, say for Daniel. We're doing the same thing now. The axis of evil looks frightening. Iran, its proxies, and we have to take it seriously. We can't rely on Nisim Gluim. We know how this ends. We know where it ends. The only question is how quickly it ends and on whose shoulders this whole history concludes. This is not even the first time that we've been threatened from Paras and Mandai. It happened before in the days of Achashverosh and of Haman HaRasha. That's why Avram witnesses Jewish history through the metaphor of animals, through the metaphor of darkness, without getting into the differences between the prism through which Avram views Jewish history and world history, the prism through which Yaakov views it. For Yaakov, it's angels ascending and descending the ladder. There are differences there. But interestingly enough, Yaakov, at this moment, isn't told that he's like, we're like sand. he's told, just checking, I think someone's trying to contact me, to maybe if the transmission isn't proper. I just want to make sure. No, it looks like transmission is proper. I apologize. Isn't told that we're referred to as sand, but we're referred to as dust. How is dust different from sand? How is dust part of this whole idea? So to understand the difference between dust and sand, we have to fast forward to the next time in history that the four empires are delineated. Okay, so I mentioned Tohu Vavohu V'choshech al pnei Sahom, at the dawn of creation, when Hashem is establishing the blueprints for all of reality. I mentioned Avraham at the Bris Bein HaBesarim, when he enters Jewish history and Jewish destiny. I mentioned Yaakov. When's the next time that HaKadosh Baruch Hu introduced the concept of four empires? Well, at a crucial, crucial juncture and seam of Jewish history, namely, as we went into our first Gullus. Remember, we take Gullus for granted. We're trying to peel back the Gullus identity and enter a more redemptive identity. But we were born into a world of Gullus. We take for granted the lack of Beis HaMikdash, the lack of Melech, the lack of Sanhedrin, the lack of Nevuah, the lack of... Sometimes people ask me, this, Judaism doesn't make sense to them. There's this problem and that problem, this deficiency and this flaw. Try to explain to them that you don't realize that we're playing shorthanded. We're missing so many aspects of full Jewish experience. From Sanhedrin to monarchy to prophecy to Beis HaMikdash to army to Urim V'Tumim. And it's a marvel that with so many elements of full bred and full banded Judaism missing, we still have created such a rich, triumphant, successful religion and culture and historical consciousness. Wait one day till we have the full arsenal at our disposal, a full moral and spiritual arsenal. You can't imagine how apocalyptic it was for them to lose their Beis HaMikdash. Just imagine what happened to our people a month ago on October 7th and multiply that. It wasn't just the people who were killed and raped and abused and tortured. I don't know if the torture was as hideous, but slavery was no picnic. Hundreds of thousands of Jews were taken into slavery. And of course, to wake up one morning and to see the Beis HaMikdash in embers. So at that point, HaKadosh Baruch Hu restates these four empires because he's rebuilding Jewish identity, Jewish mission, Jewish history. And it happens first in Sefer Daniel, and then it completes the arc in Esther. And that's why it's so important for Chazal to connect the dots between Esther and Daniel, and Hasach is Daniel, and you have to find a place for Daniel in the Megillah. How does Hashem introduce it? So there are two dreams. Nebuchadnezzar has a dream, and Daniel has a dream. And in each dream, there are four, and Chazal decode this into the four empires. Let's first start with Daniel's dream. Because Daniel's dream, it adds a lot. Obviously, every dream adds a lot, but it doesn't add to the issue of dust. Daniel's dream, there are four wild, frightening animals, the Arba Chayos of the second of Daniel's dream. Just if you're paying attention without reading the heavy, heavy Aramaic of Daniel, the first is a lion, half eagle. The second is a bear. The third is a leopard. And the fourth is some frightening, grotesque monster that has no reference, no comp, with iron teeth. If you're following at home, you want to follow at home, the lion with wings is Nebuchadnezzar. The bear is Parasumada. Again, in Chazal's classic roster, four empires. Why a bear? Why a lion? Not for now. The Greeks, interestingly enough, nice opportunity to think about this, Erev Chanukah. Why are the Greeks compared to a leopard? What does it say about Greece? I'll maybe talk about it in a few minutes. If you want, I have a shiur about this in YU Torah somewhere. Just look up my name in Greece or leopard or something. And then the final animal, which is a strange animal, is a strange admixture of a lot of different parts. And that in itself suggests that maybe the fourth kingdom is not just Rome, but some hybrid of Rome and Arabs and Islam. But that's the typical. Frightening, dominant, oppose them. It makes sense. Hashem wants to highlight the impact and the ferocious nature of these empires and the toll it will take on Jewish identity and Jewish peoplehood. It makes sense to liken them to wild and ferocious predatory animals. But Nebuchadnezzar, in the beginning of Sefer Daniel, has a dream. And of course, none of his magicians and sorcerers can decode the dreams. He puts them all to death, or threatens to put them all to death, and then Daniel saves the day. But in his dream, the four kings are compared to an idol. Okay, because in his mind, he thinks of idols. That's his reference point for authority. But the idol has different parts to it. And the top of the idol, the head is gold. The arms are silver. The chest, torso, is brass. And the legs are some form of iron. What's the difference between comparing the four empires to wild animals and comparing them to metal? The difference is obvious. We need metal. We use metal. Where would our lives be without metal? The first people to manufacture metal, the children of Lamech, Tubal Cain. Again, he had a militant agenda, but he was able to manufacture metal. Chazal say that Noach was called Noach because the land had been cursed since Adam and Cain sinned, and Noach created some mechanism to plow the land, technology that advanced plowing that allowed them to plow harsh and arid land. Obviously, he was forging metal. He took metal and created some hoe or some way to cut the land. Just looking, there's a chat, if anything I need to know about. Okay. Okay, it was just the previous issues that came about. Okay, so I'll close the chat. Namely, comparing the four empires to wild animals evokes the fear, the challenge, the intimidation, and these animals have to be defeated. We have no need for wild animals. We have no need for bears. Obviously, there's an ecological need, but human beings don't need bears. If bears invade us, we defeat them. We don't need lions. We don't need leopards. But we need gold and silver and brass. Just think about all the advances we now have because of aluminum and titanium and whatever, other metals. Think about how metals have changed your life. And metals is a metaphor. It's not just metals. Which means as follows. These four kingdoms are not just threats to humanity, but they contribute to humanity in the same way that metals contribute to humanity. They have something to contribute. But they also pose a danger. Which means that our job is not just to defeat and to vanquish these four empires, but to filter out their, whatever it is, their science, their country, whatever they contribute, so that humanity can benefit from them without falling into a moral abyss. We're the filter. We're the growth. We're not just the sand. We're also the dust. Or the dirt. Dirt is trampled upon. And that's part of the reason that we're compared to dirt. Similar to the sand, by the way. The sand pays a very high price for its protection of the earth, of the dry land. We call that high tides. We call that erosion. And we pay a price for the fact that we stand at the forefront of humanity, as we are now, protecting humanity from its own worst demons. Dirt is trampled upon. It isn't eroded, but it is trampled upon. But dirt also provides growth and advances and prosperity. And we're not just the defenders and guardians of the universe, but we're also the drivers of human progress as we've always been. I want to read to you a quote. I haven't seen Chazal articulate. I'm sure they've articulated this, but it's just the only quote that I've seen. It's a beautiful quote. Franz Kafka, who is a very, very deeply identified in a very tortured way of a Jew, deeply tortured identity, Jewish identity. You're not going to find in any of his well-known books, but he had a student or a disciple named Gustav Janach, who's a Talmud Mufak. And they would walk home every day from the insurance company, accident insurance company where Kafka was employed. And they would stroll through the promenades and the streets of Prague in between the two wars. And Kafka had a prophetic sense of where humanity was heading, where civilization was heading, and he incorporated some of that prophetic, intuitive sense into his writings. Basically, he had a sense that the world was changing quicker, faster than human imagination could keep up with. And he predicted some of the moral demise that we're now experiencing. And boy, is there moral demise. Are we experiencing moral decay in our world? Just look at the pro-rape and pro-torture rallies that hundreds of stooges are attending. And you see moral decay, the moral demise. In any event, Kafka's student would accompany him and they would talk about life and it's a highly recommended book. It's a short book, 150 pages, but I've read the book several times, and like every line is more powerful and more insightful than the next or the last. So Kafka once said as follows: the Jewish people is scattered as a seed is scattered. Remember, for many people, or Lagoyim supported Gullus, because if we want to advance humanity, we have to live with humanity. We all live in Yerushalayim, we all live in Alon Shvut. We're not going to have contact with humanity to advance them. So many people, scattering of Jews, we don't see it that way. Obviously, we believe we can best affect humanity from Eretz Yisrael, from the land of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but for many non-religious thinkers in particular, Gullus was not just a curse, Gullus was an opportunity. He writes, the Jewish people is scattered as a seed is scattered. As a seed of corn absorbs matter from its surroundings, spores and seeds, stores it up, and achieves further growth. A seed of corn absorbs matter from its surroundings, stores it up, and achieves further growth. So seeds, spores, ground is all necessary for future growth. So the destiny of the Jews is to absorb the potentialities of mankind, purify them, and give them a higher development. We absorb human potential. And all these empires weren't just wild animals, weren't just forces of darkness and void. They're gold. They're silver. They're copper. They're brass. In fact, all these metals were incorporated into the Mishkan. Zahav v'chesed v'nechoshes, in the beginning of Truma, Parshas Truma. And Chazal said, by the way, Zahav, that's Nebuchadnezzar. Kesef, money, is Parshas Mandai. Bronze, for whatever reason, is just laughing because there are deep reasons. The bronze and Hanukkah reasons, it's compared to Yavon. And they're incorporating the Beis HaMikdash. These metals were used to construct the Beis HaMikdash. Why are Chazal connecting them to four empires? Because these are not just predatory animals that threaten humanity. These are metals and ideas and technologies and values, which if properly filtered, will advance humanity towards its endpoint, towards its utopian endpoint. But how can these values be filtered so that human beings can benefit with them without being defeated by them? Well, that's who we are. We're the dust. And Hashem was telling Yaakov, at least at this point, you're not just the sand, which he told Avram at the Akedah, you're also the dust. Now, why he told Avram at the Akedah that you're the sand, and he told Yaakov at Har HaMoriah, the night of the ladder, that you're the dust, that's a whole separate issue. Why Avram gets sand and Yaakov gets dust. But either way, let me summarize before we conclude. Yaakov and Avraham both witness, each in their own way, metaphoric presentations of the four empires that will rule and dominate history, that will challenge the Jewish people, that will, in two cases, destroy the Beis HaMikdash, and in the case of Hanukkah, almost destroy the Beis HaMikdash. They're not attacking the Beis HaMikdash incidentally. That's their agenda, to defeat Hashem in this world. They want to defeat Hashem in this world. Whether they know it or not, they're trying to. The enemies of the Jewish people. Therefore, they attack the Beis HaMikdash. And the question is, why do they see it? What does this have to do with Yaakov's whole presence, with Avram's whole presence? The answer is, largely written, to be a Jew is to recognize that in addition to your ritual world of Torah and of mitzvos and of tefillin and of Shabbos and of Pesach and of all that personal encounter with the Kodesh Baruch Hu, you have a role to play. And the role to play is to inspire humanity towards a life of covenant and commitment. Not 613, we model 613 so that the world appreciates 7. Part of that task is to battle. Not just to inspire, it's easy to inspire, to write books, give shiurim, discuss values, model values. But we also have to stand at the battleground and battle evil and battle morally challenging empires. Those four empires that will rise are world-dominating empires, world-dominating monarchs, but they are Tohu, Vavohu, V'choshech, Al Pnei Sahom. They're like the waters of void of chaos that constantly want to recover their lost ground from Bereishis and engulf the dry land. They want to engulf humanity, engulf human habitat, not just geologically, but engulf human experience. They're Tohu Vavohu. They're four wild animals half lion, half eagle, bears and leopards and strange, grotesque, apocalyptic, strange animals. Who knows what that animal is, the fourth animal in Daniel, in his dream. So Hashem tells Avram and Yaakov, you, being a Jew, means you will battle them. You will defeat them. And Avram sees animals, and Yaakov sees angels hiking up and down the ladder, ascending and descending. But Hashem tells him, not only will you defeat them, but you'll also filter them. Not only are you the sand, you'll also be the dust. And you'll absorb their potentialities, and you'll purify them for mankind. So the ticket of entry into Jewish history, into Jewish destiny, is historical awareness. So know what battles we have to fight, and what battles we're fighting right now, this minute, as I speak and as you listen. To conclude, the Medrash concludes that Yaakov was a little bit intimidated by how high some of these empires and monarchs were rising. And in particular, when he saw the final wave of Malachim, because at least it sounded like from the Medrash, in the actual Psukim, it doesn't sound like there are four. In Daniel's case, there are four. Four animals in his dream, four medals on this pagan idol in Nebuchadnezzar's dream. In the beginning of creation, there are four descriptions of darkness and void, tov, vo, choshech, apenei, tahom, choshech and tahom being separate. For Avram, it sounds like there's a demarcation into foine, ema, chashecha, gidola, nofelas, olav, ema, chashecha, gidola, nofelas, olav. So there are four. Which, by the way, is very limiting and creates a big, big controversy, which I see we're not going to get to today. What does each mal fit? Because the classic roster of Chazal is, as I said before, Bavel, number one, Paras or Madai, Persia, number two. Now, again, if Iran is a continuation of Persia, so that could be the continuation of that second animal making a comeback. We killed it once, but now we have to kill it again. We have to slay it again. The third is Greece, and the fourth is generally Yava, Edom, Rome, which can be broadened to include Christianity, Russian civilization, not just Rome per se, the country Rome in Italy, but city Rome in Italy, but Chazal, some Farshim read Yishmael into that fourth animal. In any event, part of Jewish destiny is to wage these battles. Yaakov, interestingly enough, does not see four. He just sees a lot of Malachim. There's no four in the Torah, as there is for Avram, Ema Chashecha Gedola Nofelis, Tova Vav Chashecha Penezom, Daniel's four parts of the dream, which may suggest that Yaakov is seeing a slightly different version of Jewish destiny, not a different version, but a different aspect of Jewish destiny. But at least in the Medrash, he sees four waves. Wave number one, up, down. Wave number two, a little higher, falls down. Wave number three, even higher. Wave number four, climbs so high, you can't even see it. And Yaakov is afraid. And Hashem encourages him and comforts him. As high as they climb, they'll fall. So could you imagine people reading this Medrash throughout the last 2,000 years? Seeing Western civilization, Christianity in particular, those who lived in Ashkenazi areas, who were generally more persecuted than those who lived in Sephardic areas, and watching Western civilization climb and rise and persecute, and how high can they climb, and how much could they accomplish, and look at the superpowers, and what was to us, and so Yaakov didn't just witness, he witnessed the fall. Daniel didn't witness, well, actually he does. In the first dream, there's a rock that destroys the idol. But Avram doesn't witness any fall of these animals. He just witnesses the fear. Yaakov at his stage, because he's the one who wrestles with history, Yaakov, he grabs onto Esau's heel, he witnesses the fall. Olim v'yordim bo. Which brings us to our conclusion. The Medrash ends with Hashem inviting Yaakov up the ladder. And Yaakov's afraid because he knows that those who rise fall. So he doesn't get on the ladder. And Hashem promises him, no, you're different. You'll rise, but you won't fall. And he still is afraid, and with that, the Medrash ends. And there's a rebuke of Yaakov Avinu, but the Medrash ends with Yaakov being afraid, and it's not a rebuke to say that someone is frightened. When you're first starting out and looking at Jewish history, and you know the future, Yaakov's a Navi, but do we have that same fear that possessed Yaakov thousands of years ago? Hopefully we don't. And hopefully we believe in Jewish history, if for nothing else, because we've seen it. And we're at the tail end of Jewish history. And we know that our people will not fall, and they haven't fallen. We suffer, we walk down a few rungs, people surpass us on the ladder, they step on us on the way up the ladder. But all these empires came and went. Iran, Yimach Shemam, will come and go. They'll dissipate into thin air. All of our enemies will come and go. We know exactly where this is heading, as I said before. We know exactly how this all ends. We hope that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that it'll be smoother, that it'll be easier, that it'll be quicker. But Yaakov is afraid to climb the ladder. And I don't think the Medrash is rebuking Yaakov. I think the Medrash is trying to ask us, are we willing to climb the ladder? And climbing the ladder means basically doing battle with all these empires. It's a very, very different dream and a very different set of imagery than the one Avram had in Parshas Vayera. Lech Lecha, Ebris Ben, I'm sorry. There he had the animals and vultures were there. At some point he shoos them away, so that may be him distancing some of the impact of these four kings. But when the darkness settles on him, he has no response. He just has to subdue to it or submit to it and live through that darkness. Yaakov is being asked to get on that ladder. And when you're on the ladder with all these other empires, you're not just walking in a separate lane. You're trying to bring them down from their high perch and their moral challenge. You're trying to pull them down to the ground. But Yaakov is afraid that maybe Jewish history is similar to other nations. And Hashem says, no, no, no. If you ascend the ladder, you won't fall. You'll never descend. Now, is there a hidden message in the ladder? Is this partially the imperfect success of Jewish nature? Had Yaakov ascended the ladder, would that have been different? It's really, really hard to know from the Midrashim. It's really hard to make these statements. How would history have been different had Yaakov climbed up the ladder, ascended the ladder as Hashem invited him? But regardless of those questions, which are very hard to think of, it's clear that Hashem wants Yaakov on that ladder. It's clear that Hashem wants us on that ladder. It's clear that Hashem wants us to appreciate, to believe that we won't fall. Because that highway and the dynamics of that highway, those who rise fall, they don't apply to our people. Our people aren't affected by the normal political, anthropological, military, social laws that govern every other nation. That's why I didn't even know the background would be. That's why we're compared to stars. Look at the background. Maybe next time we can have a background with a little stars, a little sand, a little dirt and dust. But we're compared to the stars because the stars hover above. They aren't impacted by gravity. Zero gravity. Gravity is the basic force that affects human experience. In space, none of the natural or physical laws apply. We are kekochvei hashamayim larov. And Hashem wanted Yaakov to sense that, to overcome his inhibition or his fear and concern, and climb up the ladder. Well, we're on the ladder now. We're on the ladder of Parshas Vayetze. And it's the last empire to be drawn down so that full Geula can emerge. Where Yishma lies in the template of the four Malchios, that's for another shir. Is it only Yishmael? Will there be other nations that will join them? It seems that they may be. How this relates to the prophecies of Gog and Magog, which seem to be different than the four empires, we'll know when it happens. But one thing we know, we are now the stars battling that battle. We are certainly the sand protecting humanity against not just horrific atrocities that subhuman barbarians have committed, but against their own moral confusion and postmodern moral relativism. And just, to be honest, I don't get angry when I see some of these protests, anti-Israel. I just get sad. It's amazing to me. It's sad to see people, thousands of people, presumably who were gifted with human intellect, supporting barbaric acts of indecency, and just there's no justification. It's just indoctrinated stooges and simple-minded. So we are the sand protecting humanity against themselves. We are the dust of the earth driving humanity's progress forward. And it's that recognition and that consciousness that this isn't just a military battleground. Our sons and our daughters are now in that military battleground. Most, I imagine most of the people listening to this year are not in Gaza or not drafted in the army if you're listening to this year. But there's a spiritual and a moral battleground. And as best as we can do to maintain consciousness of our place in history and our place in defeating evil and in protecting humanity and in advancing humanity and in redeeming humanity. And quite frankly, it's not a way that we've thought for thousands of years. When we left Yerushalayim, the Jewish imagination contracted because we didn't have that much of a universalist international role. We were on the margins of society. We were being persecuted. We were being ported from country to country. We did our best just to survive and put on tefillin and eat matzah and Baruch Hashem. That's how we survived. That was our secret for survival. But now that we've returned to the stage of history, we've returned to the battleground of history. This is the first pogrom in history that's followed by a war. Previous pogroms were followed by more pogroms. Now we have a people, we have an army, we're defending ourselves, we're fighting a larger battle than the one that is unfolding in the sands of Gaza or the rocky hills of the north of Israel. We are here as we always have been here, quietly preserving Hashem's presence in this world, bravely opposing evil when no one else will oppose them, as we did to Nebuchadnezzar, as we did to Haman. Now we're defeating, on behalf of others, we're defeating those threats to humanity. We are the sand, we are the earth, and we are the stars. Let us be zocha to afeda liora. Let us have the supernal light that even the stars in the background can capture. Or chadash al tzion ta'ir v'nizke chulanu mehera li'oro yor shivisim mebreishis sheshisim mebreishis. Let us all be zocha that we stand for or and mirat Hashem. So many Jews who are now, thank God, coming closer to Judaism because they realize ki ner mitzvah v'tara or. Shkoch to all the organizers, and we should only hear besuras tavos, and we should be zocha to nisim. If you believe in them, they'll happen, but you have to first believe in them. There's a call to all who joined.